Welcome to our panel. Thank you for joining us, everyone in the audience, and to our speakers. We're gathered to discuss global disorder after liberal hegemony. In a context of war and uncertainty, we aim to discuss global level trends, system level trends, to provide context for the war in Ukraine and other conflicts around the globe, to address concerns about the direction of the international order and US hegemony within it. We have two thematic questions. Why are international politics today marked by a sense of gathering global disorder? And is liberal hegemony and its decline a source or consequence of this new era? We have four distinguished speakers to help clarify these questions for us. I'm delighted to introduce them. Trine Flockhart is Professor of International Relations at the University of Southern Denmark and co-director of the Center for War Studies. Trine's research focuses on international order, processes of change and transformation, the crisis in the liberal international order, and NATO and transatlantic relations. Daniel Nexon is Professor at Georgetown University. His most recent book, co-edited, is Undermining American Hegemony, Good Substitution in World Politics. Jason Pack is founder of Libya Analysis and senior analyst for emerging challenges at the NATO Defense College Foundation. His most recent book, Libya and the Global Enduring Disorder, explores the case of Libya and what it reveals about contemporary 21st century geopolitics. Inderjeet Parmar is professor of international politics at City University of London, with numerous scholarly books and articles on US foreign policy, and as a former visiting professor at LSE Ideas. I'm your chair, Dr. Aaron McKeel. I'm a course convener of the Executive MSc International Strategy and Diplomacy Program at LSE Ideas. We'll proceed by tailoring our specific questions to the expertise of each of our speaker. They have 10 to 15 minutes each to speak in turn. And then they'll have an opportunity to respond to one another, after which we'll turn to questions from our audience. When you pose questions, use the question function and try to indicate which speaker you're directing your question to. All right. Terrific. Trine, we'll start with you. Your work on the emerging multi-order world brings me to ask how the war in Ukraine fits into that broader trend, and whether this war is accelerating that trend to a multi-order world, and whether we can expect more disorder of this kind as a consequence.
Okay, thank you very much. And thanks for inviting me to discuss what is absolutely the topic that is at the top of my agenda at the moment. I'm very preoccupied with order and disorder, change and transformation. I'm writing a book which is looking at what I call the arrival of the multi-order world. I hate to say that for me, the invasion of Ukraine on the 24th of February 2022, it's horrible to say, fits in very well with what I'm writing, because I think that actually is the day when the global rules-based order finished and is the most solid indications of a new multi-order world is appearing. So these are our big questions that we're dealing with, and it's a real pleasure to be part of such a distinguished panel. And thank you to you, Aaron, for organizing it. And I should also say that I'm speaking to you from the relative tranquility of Florence, where I'm at the European University Institute. And until this afternoon, I was sitting in a cloister up in the hills of Tuscany, looking out over Florence. And it's really difficult to kind of comprehend that we are going through what may be the most disorderly times for generations when you sit in such a tranquil place. But nevertheless, I start from the premise that, as I said, the 24th of February 2022 signals the end of the global rules-based order. So I can start with my conclusion, which is that I think we are in for quite a rough ride. I think we have to get used to the idea that disorder, upheaval, and possibly conflict, well, definitely conflict, but perhaps even wider conflict, is going to be part of our lives for quite some time ahead. Because one of the things that is characterizing periods of transformation is, of course, that they are characterized by political upheaval, by uncertainty, by anxiety, a lot of anxiety, and a redefinition of values and identities and so on. So it's not just at the global level that everything is in flux. I think we are seeing disorder right from the personal level to domestic politics, to the international level, to the global level. And this, I think, is something that is going to be around for a while. So what I want to do is first of all, I want to look a little bit on transformation, what this means. And this is because the book that I just that I'm writing is really a book about transformation, and it's trying to develop a theory of change to add to Bull's theorizing about order. Because one of the things that you can characterize Bull about is that his theory actually didn't talk very much about change, and he didn't do that because foremost in his agenda was the idea of how do you maintain order. He was not really that interested in how orders change, because within the context of the Cold War, it was of course assumed that if the global order changed, it would be because of a catastrophic event. So the whole idea and the whole foundation of Bull's work is how do you maintain order rather than how do orders change. We're now in a different situation, and I think it's really important that we understand better how orders change and how transformation takes place. And here I have a little bit of an issue with the IR discipline, because I think because of the way IR is constructed, with creating boundaries, especially between the domestic level and the international level, it's very difficult to actually find the sources of change and the sources of transformation. One of the things that characterize processes of transformation, and they are very rare events. I mean, we in IR, we have our dates going from 1648, 1945, 1815, and those big dates, those are dates of transformation. So they're not that many dates of transformation, but I think we need to add 2022 to one of those dates. But the thing with transformation is that it's very difficult to know that you are in a process of transformation until quite late in the process, probably until a tipping point has been passed and it's too late to do anything about that transformational change. It's also very difficult to distinguish normal change, because life is full of all sorts of different forms of change, from what has the seeds for transformational change. So quite often transformations are understood with the benefit of hindsight, and they are understood when it's too late to actually do something about it. And I think this is what we can very clearly see in the way that we have been focusing on bits of transformation and change in the IR discipline for years. It's been quite clear that there's something going on, but I think it was quite late in the process that we as a discipline have realized that actually what we're witnessing is global transformation. So how do we know this? And this kind of relates to your question, Aaron, about liberal hegemony. Is it a source or consequence of disorder and order? I think to be able to understand what's going on at the moment and why we're kind of experiencing disorder in all sorts of different levels, is because there are basically two processes that I think both in policy circles, but to some extent also within the international relations discipline, have been treated as one. And this is that we have conflated the liberal international order with the global rules-based order. I think the two are different. They're two separate things. And what is in transformation is the global rules-based order. What is what we can say about the liberal international order is that this is in crisis, and it has been in crisis for at least the last 15 years or so, but it is not that one that is in transformation. And in some ways, it may well be that because the global rules-based order is now dead, if I'm right about the 22nd of February, it may be that that actually is a kind of a nudge for the liberal international order to get out of crisis mode and to actually become more cohesive and to be able to carry on within within the new ordering architecture that is emerging. So the transformation of the global order, in my view, is that we are now seeing new orders emerging. And I think that is very clear that we're seeing, if you cast your mind back to a couple of weeks or 3 weeks before the invasion of Ukraine, Xi and Putin met at the Winter Olympics, where they made an agreement about a never unlimited friendship, I think it was called. Basically, if you read that document, I think that is a manifesto for a new global order. They are agreeing their own spheres of influence that I think is a Eurasian order, and I call it a Belt and Road order, that are in opposition to the liberal international order. There may be other orders coming as well, perhaps regional orders. You could also imagine an Islamic-led Sharia order as well. There are definitely other orders on the way. But so there's change going on at the global order level, because there are more orders entering into the fray, but it is not the liberal order, the liberal international order, that is in transformation. So what can we expect? What can we expect will happen? Well, this of course depends on how will these new orders behave? What kind of orders are they? How deeply committed are they to some of the rules that so far have been guiding order at the global level? How are they going to recruit members into their sphere of influence, into their order? And here we can, of course, already see that the Russian Eurasian order, Putin's order, is quite happy to recruit members through subjugation and violence. Whereas I think the Chinese order is probably, that I call this the Belt and Road order, is probably more an order that will seek recruitment through economic benefits by co-opting states into the Belt and Road initiative, which may of course then later on lead to economic dependency. But neither of those two orders have what the liberal international order has, which is an element which is an element of attraction. And that is also able to design or to be flexible in the kind of association that you have with the liberal international order. So in many ways, I think in this multi-order world, the liberal international order is actually in quite a strong position, even though it will not be, as many have thought during the 1990s and later, and perhaps some still do, that it will not be a universal order. It will be a smaller order, but it will be open, as John Eikenbry used to say. It's open, easy to join, but difficult to overturn. So the characteristics, how much time have I got left? There's 2 minutes, 2 minutes. Will we see a continuation of disorder? Well, this depends on the relationship between the different orders. And the thing about the multi-order world is that it is the dynamics within a multi-order world is, on the one hand, that you have the dynamics that are internal to the different orders. Those are characterized by hierarchy, whereas the dynamics between international orders are characterized by anarchy. So just like Alexander Wendt says, you can have, you know, you can have cooperative anarchy, you can have conflictual, or you can have competitive anarchy. Which one it's going to be, I think, is going to be one of the questions that to answer your question about whether it is going to be a disorderly or an orderly global order that we end up with. So far, of course, it doesn't look too good. Because it looks like the relationship, at least between the Eurasian order and the liberal international order, is going to be a conflictual one. But it also looks like the relationship between the Russian order and the Chinese order, if this document signed at the Winter Olympics is to be believed, that it is going to be a cooperative relationship between those two orders. And then the big question is, what kind of relationship are we going to see between the liberal international order and the Chinese Belt and Road order? So all of these are questions that I think will be bubbling around for a long time. I don't think we're going to have the answers to this for quite some time. And I also think that what we're seeing at the domestic level, just to sort of pass the ball to Interjet, is that people experience this sort of change as deeply unsettling. And I think as long as we have this kind of disorder at the global level and the international order level, we are also going to see political upheaval, uncertainty about identities and values, contestation of those values at the domestic level for a long time ahead as well. So disorder is something I think we need to get used to. And the decline of liberal hegemony is also something we need to get used to. But it may be that you can have a smaller liberal international order that is more liberal than it has been in the past, more true to its own values than it has been in the past. I'll stop here.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much. Really helpful. Our next speaker, Daniel, are you there? Yes. Daniel's there. Terrific. All right. So moving from that introduction, on similar themes, your work on hegemonic order and your recent piece in Foreign Affairs co-authored False Dawn for Liberalism brings me to ask how the war and the response by the liberal states, the liberal democratic states, and their coherence and very forceful response, how you argue that this is not the return of liberal hegemony, but rather you argue we should not expect liberal revival. And what does that mean? What are the consequences of your argument for the future of international disorder? And do you see a more bleak future as well? What opportunities are there for the liberal order, I suppose, as well within there?
Well, thanks for having me. Yeah, the title of the piece, I think, is sort of, you don't choose your own title, sort of reflective of my views. I think that generally speaking, I always see the glass as half empty. And so when I say, when Alex and I say, you know, hey, it's all well and great that you see the awesome power of this, you know, collective liberal response or liberal democratic response, we have to keep in mind a whole bunch of things. You know, one of them is that 63 Republicans in the United States voted against the resolution affirming support for NATO as a democratic alliance. We have basically the collapse of the center right in a lot of the liberal democracies. And we all know, based on a fair amount of research and popular books, that democracy depends upon a robust center right that's committed to a democratic process. We have big divides between the greater West, you know, that is the, what may I call it, the zone of mostly liberal, but not always all liberal democracies, and not all liberal democracies in the zone or out of the zone. We have a big divide between them and a lot of the rest of the world when it comes to just how much there should be sanctions or pressure on Russia. It's all well and good that we're cracking down on Russian globalized Russian kleptocracy, but it's not a complete crackdown. And there's no indication that this is going to generalize to a grander effort to tackle globalized kleptocracy and oligarchy as it emanates not just from Russia, but from other former Soviet countries and from the West itself and from Asia. We have, what else? What other great things do we have? Well, we have my handwriting, which I can't read. Just generally speaking, for the last couple decades or the last 15 years, we've seen a real shift towards personalism in regimes, and not just in authoritarian states, not just Vladimir Putin or Xi Jinping, but also in Western democracies. We've seen the collapse of parties, the rise of personalist leaders, a return of what some call a wave of neo-patrimonialism, all this stuff. Is not a good portent. I mean, we have a crypto-fascist, a barely crypto-fascist in France that just got 43-44% of the vote, more, which is a huge number of people, even if it feels like a decisive loss. And in the United States, we're really on the verge of a return of an even more aggressive, even less democratic variant of the Make America Great. So it's all going just swimmingly in that. Now, what I want to do, and I stopped, I didn't set my timer, so how much have I used? Well, I'll just set my restaurant timer for 10 minutes. I have, what I'm going to do for the remainder of my time is I'm going to blow through some slides that are really a 30 to 40 minute presentation. You should be seeing them now. I think I want to kind of get some of the key concepts of them out to sort of make more sense, I think, of what we're seeing going on and why, as we're sort of tasked at some level of talking about why Ukraine is maybe symptomatic of other things, or why the whole game in town is that Ukraine is not going to is not the Ukraine and the war there is not the alpha and omega of what's happened. So I'm going to start out by talking about some concepts, and then I'm going to talk a bit about what I think is happening, or more properly, Alex Cooley and I think is happening, particularly that we lay out in our book, Exit from Hegemony, and a couple. So let's start with a kind of basic question, which is, what the hell do we mean by liberal order? And the answer is, I don't really know. Like, I just sort of do my best to make sense of this term. And this is kind of what we came up with. The first is that we probably shouldn't be talking about the liberal order, even though we all will and we all do. We're talking really about a world that's made up of multiple overlapping, nested, discrete orders. And moreover, we probably shouldn't even be talking about orders. We should be talking more about the kind of verb form. We should be talking about ordering, that rather than ever having a stable order, even though it may seem that way at any given moment, we really have a whole set of policies and practices and relationships that are producing, reproducing, or modifying the relationship, the order, the ordering principles, and the ordering among various actors. Now, when we come to liberalism or liberal order, we're obviously talking about a specific type of order or ordering. And generally speaking, we follow a number of people in saying that we should think about liberal ordering at both the global and domestic level, actually, global level, in terms of three baskets. And the first week is political liberalism. And that's the idea that at a minimum, governments have responsibility to protect some rights of their citizens, some obligations beyond the provision of welfare, and that at a maximum, a political liberal position would be that all states ought to be democracies. We also have a different kind of discrete set of issues and practices associated with economic liberalism. It's kind of at its base root is some sort of commitment to market exchange, opposed to strict autarky or mercantilism. But this comes in a lot of different shapes and sizes. So, very famously, we had a period of kind of New Deal liberalism or social democratic variants of liberalism. Economy of the West, we've moved towards a period of neoliberalism that might be transforming too into a kind of patrimonial approach to economics. But nonetheless, we have this, so we get a lot of flavors and a lot of variants. And finally, we have what we call intergovernmental liberalism. This is sort of at heart the idea that at minimum relations between states or relations between sovereigns have some amount of formal equality, even if we're talking about actors who are grossly asymmetric in power. So, you know, in principle, every relationship between a sovereign state is a relationship among equals, sort of an opposite kind of thing. Humans are supposed to be equal depending on your value of human, depending on what you mean by human at any given moment, liberalism. And then a maximum that you should, and so things like spheres of influence are like right out. And then at a maximum that you have multilateralism as a principle of, you know, institutions that have standing bureaucracies that engage in global governance and facilitate cooperation around standing rules and principles, kind of mirror in some ways domestic manifestations of rule. And these are always in tension with one. This very famous example or very common example from when I was growing up, you know, in the 90s and early 2000s, was that, you know, if you're going to say, for example, that we really value liberal intergovernmentalism, multilateralism, sovereign equality, that puts that restricts the ability to say push for political or economic liberalism. If you're committed to multilateral governments and standing rules, then you have to put up with Saudi Arabia being on the Human Rights Council. And so these things don't necessarily all go together. In fact, they don't go together, and they can come in completely different combinations. So we have had periods of economic liberalism without much intergovernmental liberalism. The British Empire cracking open markets for its own enrichment. They're spreading, in a sense, a form of liberal economics in a lot of places, but they're not doing it through intergovernmental principles. And so because of that, because there are these tensions and these different combinations, you sort of have a constant churn of change in liberalism order, and you have and you look over time just mutations in just both the combinations and substance of liberalism. Okay, so if we understand kind of liberal order and liberal ordering, there raises the question about like why would you contest order at all? Because what we're seeing now is primarily a lot of order contestation. So orders produce or military and economic advantages for some states. So example, like dollar hegemony, US alliance and basing network paralleled, it gives the US an advantage. And so there are always states that are losers in that arrangement, given incentive. Orders always privilege different types of regimes, cultures and norms. It gives metrics of status, affects legitimacy, what constitutes self-power. So in the book, we talk about the way in which liberal rights are kind of baked into the very constitutional fabric of post-war order, the very treaties that make up the UN. And that creates a kind of underlying presumption that liberal democracy is the only truly legitimate form of government. Obviously, that's not a good deal if you're not a liberal democracy, and you might have that. And that power transitions, which are what we're seeing now, can exacerbate these roots of contestation because they create winners and losers. You have rising states that get particularly antsy often about the ways in which they're being frozen out or losing out in order. And you have dominant incumbent states that are declining and often see the order as it stands as actually weakening them. So they have incentives to try to change them. I am not showing this in play for now. Okay. So you have then two strategies of contestation. One is we call order contestation, and this is trying to change order from within. And the other is alternative order building, which is making a different order on your own terms. So order contestation from within, you know, we saw a lot of that by the Trump administration. We see that by the Orban administration or the Orban regime in Hungary. We see this in various food fights over various things, but we also see this in terms of China and Russia working to strip human rights protections from peacekeeping operations with the UN, et cetera. Alternative order building is the kind of stuff that Kuhn was talking about when she was talking about two different orders. So we talk about, you know, Russian attempts to build the Eurasian Economic Union or the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, primarily funded by China, also actors, or the Belt and Road Initiative. So you can go out and kind of build your own if you don't like the current terms of and these can reinforce one another. You know, if you think about Russia's revisionist strategy, and certainly the one before it invaded Ukraine, involved both a kind of contestation from within, support for right-wing movements, support for rally, the National Front, support for the Liga in Italy, support for far-right movements elsewhere, attempts to exacerbate social divisions, quote, information warfare, but also that can be used often as a strategic instrument to try to demobilize opposition to or garner support for building this alternative order in terms of like the EU. What's happening to international order? By and large, there's been this great reversal. So if you go back to the 1990s, and you looked at these three baskets of liberalism, you would say that that there is an American or a Western monopoly on order provision, which you call a patronage monopoly. There is an implosion of alternative great power orders because you have collapsed the Soviet Union, so there is no like rival prestigious ordering arrangement to Western liberal order. And then you have this explosion of pro-order liberal transnational movements and activists running around the globe, running around Eurasia, post-communist society, kind of building and supporting kind of liberal initiatives. And so if you were, kind of growing up in the 90s, like I was, it looked like, it looked like, I don't know what just happened there, but it looked like a liberal order was going to be ascended. And what we argue is all that's reversed. And I could show you some cool reversing on my slides. But the basic reason it's reversing there are a variety of reasons reversing that we stress, but the basic one, the anchoring one, is the decline of the G7 powers, the decline of their economic capacity, their military capacity, and the ways in the rise of China and alternative in the fusion of economic power away from the West. And that's created the ability to build or to contemplate or to consider alternative orders. But there are other reasons, some of which have to do with the ways in which securitization of liberal order has led to produced a backlash among authoritarian states who decided that they didn't want to live with liberal order anymore. Part of that has to do with the rise of reactionary populists and left-wing populists in itself, which is a contestation from the core. And so all of these things have reversed. And while Ukraine has triggered this amazing resurgence of liberal power, it is and shown what you can do if you actually act as a confederation, the amount of latent power that is left in democracies. It's very hard to get that kind of collectivization. The odds are against it persisting, particularly for the strength of counter-order movements within the Western democracy. And so we should ultimately expect that it's still a long struggle ahead if you value the survival some kind of liberal ordering, at least in its present terms, and or in a kind of term that preserves political liberalism. And none of these basic trends have gone away. In fact, they're still accelerating. Anyway.
Okay, terrific. Thank you. I think you answered my question. We didn't get the benefit of your slides for a little bit there. They were working for a while, and then I think in the play mode, the whole thing just crashed.
So.
Yeah, okay. But we did get the content, and it was a really fascinating answer. I have some questions of my own, but we have more questions for panelists. Jason, turning to you, your work on Libya and the global enduring disorder is an interesting work. I'd like you to tell us about the concept of global enduring disorder, how it helps us understand these global trends in geopolitics, and whether the decline of US hegemony is a source of these conflicts or a magnifier of them. Over to you, Jason.
Great. Well, good afternoon, and thanks to LSI Ideas for putting together this fascinating collection of contrasting perspectives on the current state of our geopolitical order. Little did I know when I first proposed the idea of this event with Chris Coker more than 6 months ago, how relevant my book's central concept of the world being in a new era of enduring disorder would be. Although I'm a trained historian, my book takes aim at the core shibboleths in the field of international relations in ways similar and dissimilar to what we've heard from Trina and Dan already. I argue that conventional realist IR theory is not a really useful way to look at the world. And it posits that states try to maximize their interests. To me, this misses a key dynamic in both the Libyan and Ukrainian conflicts. Yes, Russia has a certain amount of economic and ideological interests in Ukraine, like keeping it in the Russian trading bloc or protecting Russian speakers or increasing the size of the Ruski Mir or preventing further NATO expansion. But none of these so-called rational interests actually capture why Putin has done what he's done, or why leaders like Orban, Trump, Bolsonaro, Raisi, or other neo-populists inherently support the current war or ongoing chaos in Libya, and feel that they stand to gain from these events. To my mind, the answer is that what we are witnessing is not just a war for Ukraine or Libya, but a war of enduring disorder more broadly. And that it's not really Putin who's solely responsible for this war, despite the Western media's demonization of him as the mastermind behind everything. I argue that there are global structural features in the current world system that undermine collective action for an ordered world system, and which allow actors like Putin and those allied with him to compel to undertake a series of actions pushing towards a world of self-reinforcing disorder, which implicitly upends the certitudes of the previous rules-based, market-based, free-trading, hegemonic, liberal American imperial world system, which prevailed from 1945 until about a decade ago. So to contrast with what we've heard from Professor Flockhart, I see the rules-based order ending about a decade ago in the Arab Spring and not just now in February. And I don't see there being alternative orders. I don't see a multi-order world. I see one global enduring disorder. I don't see Russia and China as providing alternative orders. And I'll come back to that later. The primary contention of my book is that the many key conflict nodes of the global system, like Ukraine and Libya, but also Syria, Yemen, and Venezuela, have been destabilized by the lack of coherent collective action in the world system, as Dan has mentioned to some extent, and that these conflict nodes emit further and further disorder and contagion into global geopolitics, and that key actors promote such negative feedback loops, and that this is the central feature of the historical period. In short, what is the global enduring disorder? It's these negative feedback loops promoting more disorder. Therefore, issues like climate change, tax havens, are exactly the same as civil wars and state implosions like Ukraine, Libya, and Syria, because everything is a collective action challenge and not the way things were in the period of American hegemony, where climate change was a collective action challenge, but mistaken policy towards Iraq was just that in the Pentagon, you know, Dick Cheney had the wrong policy. So I conceive Libya as a useful microcosm for understanding international developments and collective action failures more broadly. I argue that Libya in 2011 to the present was the first petri dish in which all the features of the enduring disorder were present. And then they manifested themselves in Syria and then Yemen and Ukraine since 2014, and now pretty much everywhere. I show in the book something that jives with what Dan has said, which is that the last 10 years of policy towards Libya showcase that major Western nations have acted out the ancient Bedouin proverb, me against my brother and I against my cousin, my brother, my cousin and I against the outsider. This proverb evokes the structure of an archetypical peninsular Arab tribe composed of equivalent and mutually opposed segments. The founder of social anthropology and renowned historian of Libya, E.E. Evans Pritchard, dubbed such tribes segmentary. Ironically, during the enduring disorder, this famous proverb has come to apply to the ineffective Western efforts at foreign policy coordination. It also encapsulates the post-2016 retribalization of our politics and culture in many Western societies and the inability of narrow factions to put aside petty feuds and focus on shared interests until forced to by existential threats. We can even see this dynamic in the lead up to the current Ukraine confrontation. If the Germans or other Europeans and the international community had been on board with tough sanctions and clear deterrence from the Russian troop buildup in December or January, you wouldn't have had the invasion. I particularly blame Olaf Scholz for appearing to dither about whether or not he would close Nord Stream 2 or initially preventing Baltic countries from re-exporting German armaments to Ukraine. So this chain of events manifestly reveals that the Western brothers and cousins were not able to effectively coordinate when the scary big bear was at the gates. They could only coordinate when the scary big bear had actually started attacking them. Given this framing, I see declining US hegemony as part of a self-reinforcing feedback loop inherently intertwined with the proliferation of these new forms of globalized conflict nodes, which again, I'm going to stress, are not alternative forms of order. Seen in this light, the post-2011 chaos on the international scene appears to differ not only in degree, but in kind from what came before. Not only is the international system unmoored due to a lack of American leadership, a development that long predated and will long outlast the Trump administration, but also because major powers have failed to create suitable coordination mechanisms to deal proactively with the new kinds of collective action problems presented by the 21st century. I argue that the current world system is not characterized by the multipolarity of previous eras of competition. And it's not like World War I or the interwar period of World War II. Those were eras in which each aspirant to power strove to order and expand its own rival sphere of influence. Today, we are faced with rival forms of deliberative disorder. We see this very clearly with the ongoing and like semi-permanent struggles surrounding Ukraine and Libya. To my mind, Libya's chaos interacts with the fallout from the COVID pandemic and illustrates crucial facets about the current state of the world, the political implications of globalization of a particular form of neoliberal capitalism, which I argue is inherently disordering, and the implications of America's retreat from the burdens of global hegemony, and the failure of the West to enshrine its Cold War victory in any new kind of global coordination bodies, the way that the victory in the Second World War was institutionally cemented by the UN and the Bretton Woods institutions. Like a funhouse mirror, therefore, the closer we look at Libya or Ukraine, as well as Syria and Yemen, the more we see that the salient dynamics of those conflicts reflect selective distortions of the key features of our evolving international system of global enduring disorder. In Libya, as elsewhere, we simultaneously have more of a need for global governance than at any time in human history, and ironically, less global governance than at any time in modern history. Multipolarity or rebalancing of powers does not automatically follow from the decline of America's relative power, as some IR theorists would have us believe. Just as the ensuing power vacuum in Libya in the wake of Gaddafi's ouster has not, by some magical cosmic law, elicited either the creation of a new durable organizing force to fill the void or incentivized any dominant outside power to provide order. There are various indications that the world has become increasingly Libyanized by becoming thoroughly penetrated by the key features of the enduring disorder. And therefore, development in key nodes like Libya or Ukraine merely produce and emit more violence, hot money, ideology, and media polarization that then spiral to create further disorder. Armed with this broad description of my concept of the global enduring disorder, this helps us further tackle Aaron's questions to analyze the actions of Trump, Xi, Putin, and other non-state actors in quite a different light, and to see past their seemingly transactional pursuit of certain interests into their fundamental desires, which to my mind are to break the institutions, alliances, and coordination mechanisms which could provide order to the world. And that these leaders and other actors in the enduring disorder, such as major corporations, which pursue a path which deliberately harms their long-term interests or financial bottom lines, are not motivated by normal, you know, what might be seen as interest maximizing or profit maximizing ideologies. Russia will not be richer because of Putin's actions, neither will he as an individual or his key oligarchic supporters. The same is true with Libya's main conflict actors. The same is true with many big oil companies who I've seen them. I was just running a trade mission to Libya in November. They're not maximizing their bottom line by their actions in Libya. They're just preventing change. And this is what I call incumbent psychology. So for these kind of actors, a path of compromise would produce greater wealth and security, yet they actively choose actions which lead to seemingly suboptimal outcomes. That's the key feature of the enduring disorder. My contention is that the Ukraine invasion or the ongoing Libya crisis are not understandable by traditional realist or constructivist IR theory, and hence requires a totally different conceptual framework. This is a large departure from the rational actor theories, which focus on interests and the balance of power, which undergirds most classical realist IR theory. For me, a new, more psychologically nuanced and structurally rooted approach to IR is needed, just like the behavioral economics was a corrective to classical economics. So we need a behavioral and psychological correction to IR theory. Delving deeper into this critique, some analysts perceive Putin as a master manipulator sitting atop an axis of evil. Conversely, my enduring disorder paradigm sees Russia as incapable of leading an axis of coordinated allies or ordering key nodes of power. In fact, Putin is just as bad at coordinating with his stooges in Belarus and Kazakhstan as the US has become at working with our traditional allies. It seems quite likely to me that Belarus and Kazakhstan were not only not consulted in Putin's actions, but would have actively sought to prevent them if they could, which is why Putin had to de facto occupy Belarus. And the Kazakhs refused Putin's request to acknowledge the independence of the People's Republics. This inability to coordinate is then the conceptual key to Putin's decisions and showcase that what we are witnessing, to my mind, is not a war to reinstate a new version of the old Soviet Empire or a war for the Ruski Mir, but just a war for enduring disorder. In the old USSR days, the Soviets had a coherent economic and ideological package that they could export into their sphere of influence. Not today. Even if Putin had taken Kyiv, there is no coherent economic or ideological system behind the Ruski Mir. Putin's invasion seeks simply to disorder the global economy and security architecture without providing any alternative form of order. Now, you might argue, well, that's normal. A declining has-been power like Russia would want to break the international system because he feels it no longer serves Russia. But despite its global ascendancy, China is beset by similar problems. It does not order the South China Sea or resource-rich Africa. It does not coordinate well with its neighbors. Even weak, poor, dependent North Korea and isolated Myanmar, who are its allies, don't coordinate their policies with Beijing. So even an ascendant power like China, to my mind, seeks to propagate the global enduring disorder because it can crack down on its own population or the Uyghurs in this disordered world. And this is why in the top five major global conflicts, the Chinese do not provide alternative order, neither in Ukraine, nor in Libya, nor in Venezuela, nor in Yemen or Syria. So fostering consensus and perfecting seamless coordination are just not the current watchwords of global geopolitics. Trump's exit from the White House has neither unified Americans domestically nor dramatically restored America's role as a coordinator of Western and international responses to pressing collective challenges. Just look at the haphazard Western response to Libya's shambolic electoral process and the so-called democratic transition. It's not the first time that Libya has had two rival prime ministers, but this is the first sustained period where it's no longer clear which of the rival prime ministers can say that they are recognized by the US, UK, or UN. The way I see it, the global enduring disorder is about more than particular personalities. It's about structural features. So seeking to investigate this larger premise from many different angles, while not giving too much weight to outdated great man theories of history, in my book, I investigate the realms of cyberspace, the globalized economy, jihadism, and I look at these coordination factors and see how they give rise to the backward-looking neo-populist strongmen of today. Therefore, Trump, Putin, Xi, Erdogan, Orban are not the primary drivers of events. They are merely brought into being as symptoms of the way in which the current global system operates. Therefore, their individual departures from the scene are not likely to make a large difference unless their replacements have a popular consensus from the populaces to reorder the world system, which I don't see coming into being. So the defining feature of the enduring disorder is the systemic lack of coordination and collective action mechanisms for mutually beneficial aims. Look at the prevailing attempts to deal with climate change, tax havens, or corruption. There are no globally agreed enforcement mechanisms. This dysfunction is antecedent, the inability to have enforcement mechanisms, that's antecedent to the rise of the neo-populist rulers. And the very essence of neo-populism is that it requires external scapegoats like migrants or jihadis or trade wars to stay in power, and it promotes the very problems that it will solve in a feedback loop. This is the paradox which explains why at present certain major world leaders seek disorder, especially in key nodes like Ukraine and Libya, as those nodes then emit more disorder and allow the neo-populists to regain their power. I think that's a good place to stop as I presented an overview of the main arguments of my work while trying to also tackle the questions that have been posed to the panel. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. Excellent. That really does clarify my question quite a lot. Indrajit, over to you. Your work on U.S. foreign policy, lots of work on U.S. foreign policy has a number of angles. My question, modifying our themes for you, is how you characterize the global situation today, and whether you see U.S. hegemony as in decline or perhaps mutating or gaining a new configuration, rather.
Hey, thank you, Aaron, for organizing this and for inviting me, and also for the privilege of listening to Trina and to Dan and to Jason as well, and I thought I was already confused. I think I'm even more confused now than I was about 45 minutes ago or 50 minutes ago. But even the title of the web seminar today, you look at every word in that title, global disorder after liberal and hegemony, I think we could have a seminar on each one of those and not agree whether it was order was global in the first place, that disorder is necessarily a bad thing, that really it is over or after, and that how liberal and when and where and who was liberal and hegemony, whether we had it, whether it was always unstable, and whether it's actually over. So I think it's fascinating as scholars, but frightening, as Trina said, as human beings living through what seems to be a truly terrible time and with little prospect going forward of major change in truly positive directions. So in that regard, I think I find interesting what Trina said about the personal all the way through to the global. Trina sat in the hills above Florence in tranquility. I'm sitting looking out of my window of my study in London, and I'm going to enjoy a very nice dinner in a very comfortable home in a neighborhood, peaceful and tranquil as well. So it strikes me as somewhat we're in a schizophrenic situation where there's all kinds of things going on simultaneously. And I think that's what I find most interesting and also most difficult, that I wonder whether if all generations of scholars and humans think that their era is more complex than previous ones, but it does seem to me that there are more significant factors at work at domestic and global levels simultaneously today than there has ever been, or maybe we could record. And it makes it very, very difficult to actually understand A, what is actually happening empirically, and what is happening empirically is really driving major forces, and what is that going to lead to? And I guess in a way, as scholars today, we're kind of called on more and more to have instant analysis, instant explanation. And we try to do our very best, but it's very, very difficult, let alone to predict outcomes. But it strikes me there are two things which I think we can all agree on, and I think everyone here has already said so. And two articles recently I found very interesting in regard to factors and processes in the world, domestically as well, which are clear. One was an article in International Affairs recently by Milan Babic, who argues that we are actually in an era of crisis, domestic and international, and that we need to understand the crisis, as having a particular life of its own, that we are in the somewhere in it, we may be towards the end of it, as Trina suggests, we do not know where we are, I think, until we are 20 years out of it, and we don't know where that might be, but we are in the crisis. That is agreed upon by people, regardless of their theoretical or philosophical background. The other article, Aaron, and I'm not sucking up to you because you organized this, but it was your own article in International Relations recently, where you talk about disorder and disordering and the possibilities of reordering. Again, things not working, things going pear-shaped. And Jason, I thought your presentation was fantastic. I have to think about it. I need to read your book, clearly. I'm not entirely sure that I fully agree, but there are certainly areas where I'm not in agreement as well. But if we look at those two approaches of Babic about crisis and Aaron in regard to disordering at the domestic and the international levels, I think there are two certainties. We are in those moments. And maybe we should focus perhaps a bit more on the dynamic and significant factors and forces which are operating today and try to get a measure of those crises in order to try to maybe get a grip on where we are, let alone where we may be going. And I think there are two things that help us in regard to understanding our time. And that is, one is theoretical, and I'm going to put forward a particular theory, but I'm suggesting that theory itself is very important, or multiple theories are very important in highlighting and sort of illustrating or illuminating certain areas of life, certain kinds of evidence, which become important in particular kind of theories. But I would say broad and inclusive and comprehensive theory, and I would suggest that a kind of combination of Gramscian ideas and Kautskyan ideas might give us that kind of breadth. And I'll try to talk about that in a moment, a little bit more if there's time. But theories which take into account the domestic, the class inequalities, racial factors, but also global or international factors in their combinations and in their interactions and their kind of feedback loops with one another. And the second, I think, is to do with a global approach to knowledge and to evidence gathering. That is to say, breaking the limitations of Eurocentrism, that our gaze ought not to be only on the internal dynamics of the powers that be and the systems and orders they have built and are sometimes actively disordered, but also knowledge of the people and lives and experiences, how those orders and disorders have touched them and impacted them and impacted therefore how they think and how they then behave as a result of actions taken by others. And really, in a way, combine those with existing powerful structural forces as well. So you may break the gaze of Eurocentrism, but you are not necessarily abandoning it, because it is the interactions of this multiple sort of universe of actors, I think, which is what produces outcomes. So what I want to do, if I have time, is to offer six key factors and forces to consider in the current world situation, and then claim that a very good way of explaining those factors and how they operate together, that Gramsci and Kautsky offer us a way to see it clearly. But as I say, I think multiple theoretical approaches are probably the only real way to get a full comprehensive set of pictures from which we can then kind of maybe use these different pictures in different at different levels and get a bit different kind of understanding. So I guess the net result of what I'm making claims about today, in crudest terms, is that the world will likely come close to World War III, but will avoid it, I hope. That turbulence and ruptures, de- and realignments in the world are the only things that we can be certain about. That American and Western structural power remains dominant, but challenged and changed. And that the principal sources of crises and disorder and the possible solutions to them arise in forces which are locked in combat at home, in the domestic realm, within the major states, that is class, racial, and other conflicts that are challenging and undermining neoliberal hegemony, its political economy, its ideological dominance, and its political parties. And that we are getting movements towards post-neoliberalism and towards global statism, but also those are forces for change, but also we need to see, as many colleagues have pointed out already, that the forces of the status quo are, if you like, remain very, very powerful, and they're deeply entrenched. So in a way, we are kind of locked in an, kind of a situation of sort of immovable forces and irresistible, immovable objects and irresistible forces. And that seems to be the kind of dynamic within which we are operating. So in terms of these six key factors, which I think we need to take into account, they're not necessarily in a particular order, but I think they're all six are important. The first one is perceived American unreliability, instability, and domestic strife, including ultranationalism and Trumpism without Trump, but also a broader, greater focus on domestic issues, which means that emerging powers, which have come through the successes of the US-led order, are not necessarily going to be relying on the stability of the United States in that order, and therefore are reaching out to others who may, they feel, may be more reliable, at least to hedge and to balance. The second is, I would say, the technological revolutions, particularly the energy revolution and the energy order in the new in the world today, which has changed the geopolitics and geopolitical relationships, the shale revolution itself has made the United States energy independent and an exporter, and it's exporting more to Europe since January 2022 to Europe liquid natural gas than is Russia. That is a major shift in the global power regimes, which has now changed the relations between the United States and the Middle East, between the Middle East and Russia through OPEC Plus, and has having major other geopolitical ramifications. The third is that the emerging powers themselves, while more powerful, are also unstable and insecure to different degrees. And they're made so due to the effects of globalization itself, and that these insecurities and instabilities are represented politically and ideologically in ethno-racial or religious terms, and they feed into long-standing resentments and national conflicts. Fourthly, however, these emerging powers, they remain dependent on the largest economic and core powers of the liberal international order and its regimes and systems, including the West, but also on other emerging powers too. And they are now less unequally dependent than they used to be on the core powers, and hence have more room for maneuver, for balancing, for hedging behavior. Fifth, I would say that the global South may not be a unified entity, but there are elements which have been unifying it. And that one part of that, I would say, is increasingly powerful because of the extra confidence of global South and emerging powers. And that is the humiliations and resentment and anger of the colonial and post-colonial periods of massive violence in the Third World and global South, I think, combined with that extra confidence in world affairs, are having important ramifications in their relationships with the West. And they may be playing out in various ways in the current Ukraine conflict as well. And sixth, I would argue that the United States and Western resilience should not be underestimated either. The continued structural power on a global scale may be temporarily demonstrated in the Ukraine conflict, but it is absolutely ferocious. I don't know if that level of power, that level of comprehensive or systematic unified mobilizations among allies, and there are probably 18 entities, states and blocs, which are involved in this. So it's not the majority of the world, it's populations represented there, but it certainly is unparalleled and unrivaled. No other power could pull together such a coalition to take such action at such a level to almost cancel Russia, apart from the energy exports to Europe, to almost cancel Russia. It's the weaponization of interdependence, totally weaponized against one particular country. And I think that is a remarkable thing. It, as Dan says, I'm not arguing that it's going to resurrect the liberal order or whatever, but it does suggest one thing, which is that these powers are good at mobilizations for coercion. That maybe that in the new world disorder, that coercive power, the weaponization of everything, of the dollar, of financial systems and so on, that may be their raison d'etre in the next several decades. So what I would argue is that, I don't know how much more time I've got, probably about 2 minutes. And I think I've pretty much drawn the kind of conclusions, already hinted at them in my introductory kind of segment. But what I would say is the reason why I think Gramsci and Karl Kautsky are relevant here is that Gramsci offers a theory of hegemony and of crisis, a theory which combines coercion and consent, violence and persuasion, hard and soft power. It has an idea about historic blocs, national and transnational, and how they are always, if you like, in flux, vulnerable to schisms, but also temporarily held together behind a particular concept, but always prone to crisis. And I think we're in the middle of one in particular. But he also argues that crises are defined not only by the deconstruction of systems, but also there are moments, as Stuart Hall says, there are moments of reconstruction as well. And that is, you may be able to see even if you can't recognize it at the time, that there are elements for reordering, transformation and change, which are going on in, within the crisis itself. And I think the reason why Karl Kautsky is interesting to me is because of his particular theory on ultra-imperialism, which suggests that at the international level, great powers need not necessarily end up inevitably in inter-imperial warfare. And I think what there that chimes with the Gramscian idea of transnational historic blocs is that one can have conflicts at certain levels, but also have interdependencies and so on at other levels. And it is that kind of multiplicity of levels at which international relationships are developing, such that that prevents warfare of a catastrophic kind, but it does not mean that we are through, we don't end up in turbulence, tension, anxiety, disorder, and a very large number of flux and change. And as Trin says, and others have said as well, there may well be a emerging a number of different kinds of blocks of powers, which will have certain kinds of economic interdependencies and so on, as well as various kinds of conflicts. But I would stick with what Dan said as well, from a different theoretical perspective, that I suspect that the greatest disorders and the sources of disorders are largely domestic, and they are probably the ones which are likely to destabilize the world far more than necessarily international conflict itself. Okay, I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Angie. That was terrific. That was really, really nice for me to give a big global overview of this complex crisis situation that we've been trying to explore. I'm going to pose a couple questions for each of you so you can respond to each other, and then we'll open up to the audience. We'll start with Trin. I see a number of agreements and disagreements across the panel, and I'll try to tease these out. Trin, you see the idea of the restructuring of the system, we're going through a turbulent system. It's not globalization, it's kind of fracturing, structural change. At the same time, all the panelists seem to agree that there's something transnational and domestic going on too. How do you put that transnational contestation, political movements into your picture of the emerging fractured multipolar international order? How do you square that? And other panelists, of course, can join in too. But Trin, first with you.
You want me to answer now?
Absolutely.
Thank you. All right. Well, I actually think that globalization and the multi-order world are kind of necessary, because if we didn't have globalization, then we would just be back in previous times where there were different international orders, but they didn't have any relations. So what makes it interesting now is that you have different international orders emerging, and because of globalization, they have to have relationships with each other, and that makes it complicated. The other thing is that makes it complicated is what you're talking about, is the transnationalism. And I'm sitting here in School of Transnational Governance, which I think says something about the importance, the fact that the UI has set up a whole school about transnational governance says something about how the whole idea of transnational information flows, relationships, forms of contestations, forms of support is something that is important for our understanding of both global and international and domestic order. Because I think all three of them, and you could probably add others as well, all three of them are completely intertwined, and they are co-constitutive of each other. So the way that you end up with disorder, as Interjet says, you need to look to the domestic level. You need to look at different kinds of change processes that are having an effect on the domestic level, on the individual. If we are looking at, for example, the technological revolution, how does that make the individual feel that they are, that you're living in a highly changeable society, and you have to keep up with it. That is going to lead to uncertainty, that is going to lead to contestation, that will have political effects, and that may trickle up to the other levels, but may also trickle in transnational ways around in the system. So I really like that Jason was talking about negative feedback loops, because that is very much part of what I'm looking at as well, that all orders, and I am talking about ordering, just like Dan was suggesting, all ordering domains, whether they are at the domestic level, whether they are at the international level or the global level, they will have to react to different forms of change. All societies have to react to change. They have to adapt in order to stay resilient. And some of those inputs are going to be transnational inputs. Some of them are going to be domestic input. Some of them are going to be just emergent change that happens in a modern risk society, kind of alembic, in a society that is, or a planet that is facing climate change, etc. So all of these inputs are going to have an effect on ordering at all the different levels that I'm looking at. I know I probably should have had a figure, a slide to support this argument, but I hope you can get the gist of what I'm saying.
I think I can. That's terrific.
A complex picture.
Yeah, this is a really complex and large scale picture we're kind of exploring here. So Dan, the next question I have generate is for you, but also playing off Inderjeet's contribution as well. So structural power seems to be a point in which you may or may not disagree with one another. Now, Inderjeet, your Gramscian approach really picked up on continuity and structural power and the sticking resilience of the order. Dan, you're suggesting that there's something that is not so sticky about structural power. Where do you see structural powers as playing a role in your argument?
So can you hear me now? Okay, I've actually rejiggered my entire microphone setup to hopefully avoid this problem of fading in and out, which has been plaguing me for the last couple of days. I don't want to take a ton of time because I know I've been in these audiences. You want to get to the audience questions, and you don't want to hear us blather on that much longer about one another. I will just say that I come at the idea of structure from a perspective where structure is a kind of relative stability and patterns of interaction. And so structural power is paradoxical because it is power that appears natural, appears detached from what people are doing, but ultimately is dependent upon that. So one of the major criticisms that we made in the book and in a couple of articles about Trump foreign policy was that Trump was correct that the United States would get better deals if it engaged in bilateral negotiations. And so in that sense, it makes a lot of sense to break up even US-centered multilateral institutions and ordering mechanisms because you get that asymmetry. Easier to get a good deal with the UK by itself than it is by the EU. But on the other hand, a lot of US military power and structural power is caught up in this complex web of relationships. Some of them are interdepartmental, interpersonal, that are created and sustained through institutions like NATO and through the activities of engaging an alliance. And that creates an enormous amount of influence and leverage that appears to just sort of be part of being the United States, appears to be like a special sauce or some sort of intrinsic bound to lead kind of thing, but really is the result of these practices that can be undermined and destroyed. And obviously that's not going, but that's certainly what the rhetoric was about. So I think in that sense, I think we might talk more about infrastructural power than might be a better kind of everyday way of talking about it, but for me that is structural.
Thank you. Yeah, thank that. That's really, really kind of helpful textbook definition, structural power. I think it's one that should play a picture, part of the picture. But I guess change is a real question for Jason and energy at the same time. Before we go to the audience, we're talking about negative feedback loops. We're talking about disruption to the international system. And Jason, you have the really interesting point that it's a deliberate disorder, negative feedback loops. The classic notion is that disorder serves the interests of the dissatisfied. How much of this is dissatisfaction with the international system? How much is this deliberate disorder self-serving for different actors in the international system, rather than simply a structural outcome, unintended? Is it a self-serving expression of dissatisfaction? That's for Jason and Indigi and anyone else.
I'm happy to start there. Yes, a traditional approach to international relations is that losing powers, or powers who have lost, as well as domestic groups, might want to express that discontent through protest. Protest could be blocking an oil terminal, it could be going on strike, it could be starting a war. And I don't contest that. I think that that's 100% going on. I'm merely introducing another concept, which is that dominant powers, be it Trump or Brexity Britain in certain ways, and then Xi, even ascending powers like China, could be seeing a world of greater disorder as suiting their interests domestically. And I think Indrajit made some, you know, great contextualizations of the interplay between domestic and the international order, and Dan has also commented, and Trina, that it is this domestic feuding in our societies which makes them impossible to coordinate with other societies. And I think that this is clearly the case with something like climate change and tax havens. If there was 100% consensus in the United States about carbon emissions, it would be much easier to coordinate and create enforcement mechanisms that would penalize, you know, people who burned coal in other countries. But we don't have a consensus in the US, so how can we possibly coordinate abroad? And then this gets at the really great points that Indrajit and Dan have made about the US special sauce is our coordinating capacity. What is NATO? It's an ability to coordinate 30 and soon to be 32 militaries. It's not just power itself. And what is the US role in having almost all oil and gas priced in dollars? And now, because of fracking, we export gas. It's not that we have the preponderance of gas, it's that we have the coordinating capacity and our potential ways to work with our Gulfy allies and elsewhere. What I argue is not that the US is lacking in hard power. We have the most hard power, we have the most economic power. It's just that we don't use our coordination capacity to prevent disorder. And I don't think that we're doing that in Ukraine. This very reactive response in getting the allies on board or whatever, this isn't proactive. This isn't containing disorder. Clearly, the world is more disordered now than it was in December. So, yes, we can overstate the extent to which the US hegemony has declined. We've seen the power of SWIFT code system, of, you know, the ability of the US president to share intelligence and get allies on board. It's just, I argue, we're not doing this in a way which solves the pressing ordering needs and creates institutionality. And there's no treaty that ends the Cold War world. Or if there is a treaty, it's the 1994 Budapest Memorandum, and we don't honor it because it's supposed to protect Ukrainian sovereignty. So there's not going to be a treaty to end this war, which creates an enduring global system that we enforce.
Last word, Indrajit.
Yeah, I mean, as usual, confusion and disorder ourselves intellectually. But I think one thing I would say, Aaron, is that when I sort of focus on the domestic as a key source of disorder and the possible basis upon which solutions to disorder may come, I think it is linked to the kind of structural power of the big corporation and big corporations within the globe, within domestic politics, economy, and in the global economy as well. And that it is the almost untrammeled power of the big corporation and the enabling roles of the states in that process over the last 40, 50 years, which has created the democratic illegitimacy at home, which has generated the basis of the virtual undermining of the mainstream political parties. As Dan said, one of the two main political parties in the United States is a European-style far-right political party. Barbara F. Walter, in her book, How Civil Wars Start, talks about factionalization. Factionalization is a state on the brink of a civil war. That is the pivotal state in the world today. The United States is seen by people who study civil wars all around the world as close to the brink, under Trump at least, on the brink of a civil war. And the reason why such crises are so widespread at or uneven levels is to do with the illegitimacy within which mass of the electorates and populations see their own established political systems not serving their democratic interests, not serving their economic and financial interests, and allowing someone like Elon Musk to buy a corporate a company for $43 billion and so on. And there is no problem with that. And that's why I would argue that we've got to look really at the base level, because it is the movement of people and populations and protests which is driving disorder. A lot of people will vote against elites purely because they're against the elite, not because they got an alternative, but they hate what is happening today. And I think those forces are loose. They are loose everywhere. And I think that is the problem. And until the level of kind of, if you like, the democratic deficits at home are filled and the entrenched corporate power is challenged and trammeled and trimmed back, I don't think that stability is going to happen. And that would require a kind of the hyper-globalization, a reform of hyper-globalization to an understanding that we're all mutually vulnerable in a hyper-globalized world. And we have to have some level of looking after your domestic populations, which is what all those capital controls, which were removed, didn't enable countries to do. So I would argue that that is where the kind of mother load is for us to look at.
Thank you, Indrajit. All right, in time remaining, I'm going to turn to the questions that are piling up from the audience. Really interesting, good questions. Some of them directed at specific speakers, some general. I'm going to start with one for Trina. It's an interesting one about to what extent do you think foreign countries need to be involved in resolving a given conflict? This is interesting. I suppose that relates to intervention, but also peace and security more generally. Where is the UN Security Council system in a multi-order world? And what role is there for suppose closed spheres of influence and this picture of peace and security in your order, your picture of the emerging order?
Yeah, well, if you sort of, obviously the multi-order world is a kind of an ideal type. I don't think there's going to be a real multi-order world as it was. But if there were, then the logical conclusion would be that multilateralism is something that takes place within orders, because multilateralism is something that is between sovereign states, whereas governance between international orders will be something different, where it is not sovereign states that are meeting, it is actually a composite unit as an order that will kind of push everything in terms of governance up to something that is maxilateralism, you could call it perhaps, or some, it may also be that it becomes minilateralism, sort of coalitions of the willing, that that you get some sovereign states coming out of their order relations and go together with other states. So I think the easy answer, without taking all the time that's left, is that cooperation in a multi-order world is going to be much more messy than it is between sovereign states, because there is going to be different forms of cooperation, whether it is between international organizations, whether it is between international orders, or whether it is something that is a sort of, you know, involving other actors, including international, not international organizations, corporate organizations, and so on. So much, much more messy picture emerges.
Excellent. Okay. So there's another question that overlaps with this one from the audience, from Sandra Augustenborg. It's about international law. What is the future of international law? How is it changing in this era of disorder? It's being broken more often, but is it being rewritten or enforced in self-serving ways? What? Because it seems to be a very important part of order and disorder, international law. And this is for the whole panel. We can start with Inderjeet. I see you nodding, if you like, and then Jason.
I think it's a great question, but I think okay. Jason had his hand up.
Jason, hand up first. Yeah. After you, Jason.
Thank you, because I'm going to draw actually on Inderjeet's comment about the globalization of neoliberalism. I would argue that the law that we've globalized, the law of untrammeled capital to make a profit, is not one that promotes order. It doesn't protect free access to markets. It's not even capitalism. And this is what I explain in my book. And therefore, yes, the international law as we have it, it's fascinating. It doesn't even help necessarily companies who are owed money for real work that they did get their money back. Libya and Russia have cracked, and that I explain in chapters 4 and 5 of my book, and hacked global capitalism to win at arbitrations in the ICC in Paris and to essentially defeat any kind of thing that we might call an international order. The laws that we have protect the secrecy in the Cayman Islands and British Virgin Islands shell companies. That's the law of the land. And I use various examples from trade missions that I ran in Libya to, you know, Russian oligarchs that I interviewed for my book, of ways that they tell me, yes, this is the law that's on the books. We never had to pay back that money. And the reason for this, to my mind, is the ways in which statist countries, when they had their political revolutions, say against Gaddafi or against the Soviet Union, they had a political revolution without an economic revolution. So what we have in Putin's Russia and post-Gaddafi Libya is all the corrupt statist broken institutions with a new political leadership that doesn't use them for what their purposes was, globalized to a massive scale. And the implication for that on international law is that the law protects the predations of these institutions. And Fortune 500 companies, as Inderjeet has mentioned, have also created a law unto themselves, which is not necessarily about keeping markets open or order.
Okay. Inderjeet, do you want to come in, or Dan?
Just very briefly, international law or international agreements and honoring them. You look at Ukraine today, and then you look back in the 1990s in the agreement between the United States and Russia about the nuclear weapons in Ukraine. Ukraine was supposed to have security guarantees. Ukraine gave away probably the one thing which many countries have learned is essential to not being invaded. That is, you have your own weapons of mass destruction. That's why North Korea can not be invaded. And there are countries which have learned the hard way, Libya, that if you give them up, you're going to get invaded. Ukraine gave that up as a prior to its statehood. it was like a body on an operating table in an operating theater with two global power surgeons, great power surgeons, carving it up, but giving it the vulnerable no guarantees whatsoever in practice. That's international law. And that's why there's so much resentment everywhere in the world that it's the rich and the powerful that get away with it all the time because they can. No one can sanction the United States. I've never heard of sanctions on the United States. I wouldn't dare to sanction, you know, in whatever way I could. How can you? That is it. And in that regard, realism is a very powerful theory.
Excellent. Okay, we're really close to time. I want to include everyone's final comments. Dan and Trent, do you have any final comments, perhaps on international law and great powers being above it, or any final say on the larger topic as well?
Can I just say something that I think emerges from some of the questions from the audience that we weren't able to get to? It's very easy, particularly when you talk about things like challengers or contestation, to give the impression or slip in the impression that an order, a status quo order, is good and that challenging it is bad. And I think that, and I think we have to be careful because there are plenty of reasons to that some of the panelists have just talked about that are talked about in some of the questions why plenty of people should be unhappy with contemporary international ordering or various forms of contemporary international. So there is this sort of status quo bias that slips in, and you have to be aware of that, right? And that international order means something different if you are living in Washington, D.C. than it does if you're living in Nairobi, right? Or if you're living in any number of places. But I would say, I do want to say one thing, which is that we also shouldn't take away from that the idea that things that are bad, that we think are bad, or things that are maybe less legal rational, right? That is less sort of consistent or fair or following legal principles, are somehow disorder. There are orders that are composed mainly of organized warfare. So if you look at medieval Europe, war was the norm, or early modern Europe, peace was an aberration in that. And so we shouldn't, just as we shouldn't say that order is good, we shouldn't label anything that we consider bad disorder. Oftentimes it's a form of order. It's just not one that we find comfortable.
Really important point. Trine, last comment for you.
Yeah, I like the idea that that we shouldn't just think of order as the status quo. I don't think the status quo is possible in a changeable world. And also that what is my order is not necessarily someone else's order. So the concept that I operate with in the book I'm writing and in recent articles is the concept of the good life, that each order has its own concept of the good life. And in a way, I mean, I think a move towards a multi-order world is a good thing, because one of the reasons why the rules-based order doesn't work is because it has been completely intertwined with the dominance of the liberal international order and liberal dominance over the last 200 years, so that the rules of the global rules-based order are essentially Western liberal rules. And of course, they are not the rules that have been chosen by other peoples in the world. So in some ways, I think having different orders is not a bad thing. It's a good thing because it is a way to honor different conceptions of what is the good life.
I think it's a really optimistic, uplifting point to end on. I want to thank all our panelists for all their contributions to our discussion. We had a rich discussion this evening. And I want to thank our audience for all of your questions. I'm sorry for the ones we didn't get to. And everyone at ALC Ideas that has helped make this possible as well. This will be recorded and put up on the ALC Ideas website and available online in future. Thank you again, everyone. Look forward to seeing you again soon. Take care.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks everyone for coming.